welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock, Ezra Ginsberg, Michael Remus. Producer Tim gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. Talking football this hour. Next segment, we will talk a little bit about the Bomber game last night. Ezzy and I were there, and I can report that we have now defrosted, so that's exciting. Right?
I hope so.
You weren't listening, were you?
It was a good game. The Bombers...
We're talking about the next segment, though. I was just saying if you've defrosted.
Yep, we've defrosted.
You okay there?
Chemistry is... impeccable.
As usual. NFL Films.
What do you guys talk about when you're at the games?
As he talks to the people next to him.
That's why is there silence?
Well, because clearly you're looking at you to talk. But
and you're upset about the lockout, aren't you?
It's pretty depressing, that's for sure.
The games or the lockout?
What games?
Like you and I going to the games together or the lockout?
No, the lockout.
Okay. Ezzy and I actually enjoy each other's company when we go to the Bomber games together.
Ezzy. Yeah? Well... Well, I don't, sure, Drew, that got a little bit weird, but yes.
Well, we don't enjoy each other's company
in
the studio.
For 15 years, so, yeah.
Steve Sable, who was he wasn't the creator of NFL Films, but he was the driving force behind NFL Films, passed away this week at the age of 69. He passed away he had brain cancer. He was diagnosed first in March of 2011. He passed away earlier this week. NFL Films is the original 24/7.
That's right.
It took you behind the game, behind the scenes, and made every single NFL game, interview, play, interaction seem like it was the most dramatic, most important thing that could happen in the sporting world.
Well, I think, Drew, the craziest part about that is it was 24/7 so long ago.
Yeah.
I mean, remember, you know, we obviously do a hockey show here, and there's no hockey... mainly lots of hockey to talk about, but I think the point is that 24/7 just came to the NHL recently. And I think that they're basically 30, 35 years behind the NFL because the NFL's had it for so long. It's incredible to think about, and it's a credit to the people who thought of it, and also Pete Rozelle.
Yeah, Steve Sable, I mean, his father, Ed Sable, who started the business, who was the original driving force, Pete Rozelle, famous NFL commissioner, Art Modell, you know, who was really one of the driving forces behind putting the NFL, sort of gaining more of a television presence for the NFL. Art Modell, who just passed away a couple weeks ago, September the 6th. You know, he was the one who came out with the advent of Monday Night Football and everything. Mm-hmm. They said, let's put cameras everywhere. But, you know, we control it. We control the film. We control the audio. There are cameras. So we can use it as a propaganda arm. And each and every year, they produce 1,000 miles of film. It's a staggering amount.
It is.
It's an absolutely staggering amount. Because, I mean, you know, you remember back...
Like, think about it again from a hockey perspective. Ezzy, how much would you give to hear Scotty Bowman coaching the 70s Habs and interacting with Ken Dryden or Bob Gainey or Steve Schott?
Or not interacting with them just the same. Letting
exactly.
them go to their own devices. However he discerns... You get to see how a coach handles his team in a behind-the-scenes format.
And it's incredible. I mean, what it gives you is that different perspective. And, of course, what they do, the narration of that by... I think people... They make it sound like a movie. It glorifies the game, but in such a positive way. And it makes it so much more appealing.
Well, Chris Berman... You know, obviously of ESPN had a great line. You know, he said that the Sables, so both father and son, could make a 49-14 game, a game that you and I would all, and everyone around the table would say is a blowout and probably not that entertaining of a game. He could make it seem like some kind of epic Greek tragedy. And that's what he was. He was a storyteller. And he told the stories of these NFL games and NFL teams, some of which weren't very good. Some of these teams were pretty lousy teams, probably. And he made it seem like it was the most dramatic and most fascinating thing that you could ever watch.
And if you remember, the one of the things you're reading about this is the 86 Bears and being on that team and that defense. 85 Bears. And how he wanted to try and capture that feeling. And so what he did was he put a helmet on top of a camera, and he walked it out onto the field as if he was a defensive or offensive player, more so a defensive player really on that team, to give fans a look at what that would be how that would feel. And the music, of course, Remus. I mean, the music just does it all.
You know, to have the vision 30 years ago, to have cameras everywhere, to record everything, to really show the intensity and, you know, the physicality and the emotion that's involved in football is unbelievable, because they have all this footage still archived, which is so valuable, and so valuable to, you know, helping create the NFL Network and a lot of their programming. And you watch it, it's in slow motion. You see things that you wouldn't see, you know, on a normal broadcast. They have the music that makes it just seem so epic, that has been, you know, linked to football. And then you have the narration, which is, people call it the voice of God, you know, saying that deep booming voice describing the play and telling these incredible stories.
And you know, you think about the movie Rocky and how the close-ups and the spit flying from Apollo Creed's mouth, whatever it may be. It's the same thing of this in real terms in the NFL. You see, they get really in close on the lines and the offensive defensive lines, and you see mud and you see spit and you see just sweat, and you see
everything. It's storytelling. It's the same as a movie. It just happens to be real life.
Well, it's funny that it is the storytelling, and it's also just the production value.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And the whole show that is the NFL. And that's why, you know, even someone like me, who's not the biggest NFL fan, will watch NFL films and get really into it because of the production value. And really, each game feels like a movie. And obviously, this guy was not only big to the NFL, but you know, he was big to the whole production, because the HBO 24/7 series, it probably wouldn't exist without NFL films and the popularity of NFL films.
Absolutely right. None of these would exist without that, because this was the first one. This was the pioneer where sports leagues realized that, you know, I mean, it is propaganda, but it's, you know, not that's, and I don't say that in the negative connotation of the word. It's a way for them to sell the game and publicize the game as something you can't miss. And when it's a real life movie happening before your very eyes.
Look at all the football life movies they're putting out now. Bill Belichick, Ray Lewis, they're all great. The Vince Lombardi movie. What do you think how do you think they made those?
Well, how they got the access, because they knew that NFL films would.
We've talked about that Lombardi movie and how they have video of him talking on the sidelines, and they wouldn't have that if not for that. I think it was Super Bowl. It was the Super Bowl III.
Yeah.
Or that championship game. It was AFL.
NFL championship. Yeah. I mean, you know, you take
Drew was six when that happened.
Thank you. You take Bill Belichick. Bill Belichick's known as a pretty private guy.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you don't think of him as being, you know, being very open to
exactly.
to wanting cameras inside. But when NFL films and the Sables. And Steve Sable calls Bill Belichick and says, hey, we want to put a camera on you. Or, hey, you know, Hard Knocks, the Hard Knocks series. It's all part of the same.
That's right.
It all originates from NFL films, and they know that they're in good hands.
That's right.
You know, when it's got the NFL film stamp next to it. I remember watching these, you know, they have the sort of the year in review of each of the individual team. They sort of, you know, they condense it into a one-year documentary. Oh, pardon me, a one-hour documentary. And the San Francisco 49ers, who won that day in Arizona, would go on to a 4-12 record.
Yeah, yeah.
And you think it's the greatest thing in the world.
You're all of a sudden you're a 49ers fan.
Yeah.
4-12. Oh my God, how could have I missed this game?
He could make, you know, he can make Drew walks into the coffee shop, he orders his coffee black, and he has a muffin, but only the muffin top.
Nice. But it's exactly the same concept of just, you know, using the access you have to the best of your abilities. And I mean, the NHL, getting it back to hockey, is only just now starting it. But it's like you said, I mean, you know, they had that oil change documentary on TSN last year, which is sort of starting down that path, but it's not quite there yet. And it's, I mean, obviously, you know, NFL films have been around for, you know, 40, 50 years at this point in time. So there's obviously going to be a pretty steep learning curve. But the teams are realizing, or the leagues are realizing, look, these networks are desperate for programming. They want programming.
Yep.
We can produce the programming, put our rose-colored glasses on the programming, give it to them, and they'll say, hallelujah, thanks very much, can we have another team next year?
Well, I think, you know, and I think his legacy is going to be that they did it better than anybody, and they changed everything, right? It's all about those details, right? Remus was saying it's the voice of God, and then, you know, Richie's joking about it, but the reality is that it's about all the details. Sports sometimes can feel like it's, you know, these guys go out there every Sunday, offense versus defense, you know, it's a simple game. Well, it's not a simple game at all. It really is, you know, a huge, huge spectacle, and they break it down from, you know, the wind at the stadium to the celebrity that's in the crowd to what the team's record is, to who, what, you know, what, where the quarterback is at in his life. And they really have made it into much more than it really is. And it is that. And that's really, you know, impressive. That's one of the best things about the NFL is that, again, you know, someone like me who, you know, I, sure, I'm in a football pool and all that, but obviously hockey,
yeah, 2-0.
Hockey is my
Dave Vanuk right now is screaming at
hockey is my number one love. But if we were able to, and you know, we were talking about the television deal and that's expiring, but as far as I'm concerned, the NHL should be bringing that NHL films aspect to the channel instead of just having
put cameras everywhere.
Exactly, put the cameras everywhere. People want to hear their favorite players
and
take a page from the NFL Films playbook.
And if they're your cameras and you get to control it, then you don't. If you don't like it, you don't release
That's what exactly happens. The name, by the way, that the person's voice we're talking about is John Facenda. He was then, after that, the names that the voice that maybe younger generation would know would be Harry Callis, who recently passed away. He was terrific. I believe Scott Graham does that now. But I think, I know we got to go to break here, Drew, and I'll leave it on this note. The NHL lockout, some say, may end because of the league's desire to air 24/7.
HBO's 24/7.
And they'd start filming that end of November.
And exactly. And 24/7 came about probably because of NFL films. And Steve Sable and his dad were responsible for that. So think about how far-reaching the implications of their creation have been.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. To the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Shortly before 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. This segment of the show is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. For a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com or give them a call at 204-488-4520. His final shows in town after two amazing weeks. Mark Forward, one final night at Rumors, two shows tonight, 7:45 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. You can get tickets at Rumors. You can get them online at rumorscomedyclub.com, or you can give them a call at 488-4520.
Sheldon Mindell told me it's a guarantee, a Sheldon Mindell guarantee, that you'll look forward to it.
That's a terrible pun.
That never happened, that conversation.
No.
But Sheldon doesn't acknowledge Ezzy's presence. You should know that. First of all, before we get to the Bisons game last night, an update from University Stadium. The Manitoba Bisons lead the Alberta Golden Bears 17-14 after the first quarter in CIS football action.
They're ranked eighth now, or what?
Well, no, they've got a great team this year. They beat, I believe, the Huskies.
I think so.
I think they're 3-0.
They beat UBC.
They lost last week to the Calgary Diamond.
They beat UBC and they beat SAS, right? Regina.
They're 2-1. They're playing against Alberta. Hope to get to 3-1 for the big team that they're going to. The Calgary Dinos apparently are a juggernaut coming out of the, I guess, are they the Canada West Conference still?
Remember Don Blair used to play for the Calgary Dinos. Remember him? Played for the Stampeders later.
I thought you were more into Tony Blair.
Yeah.
I don't remember Don Blair, no.
You remember Tony Blair? Receiver? Very good CIS receiver. Maybe we'll get Reem to look that up.
No.
Don Blair, and then
Of course.
Yeah. No, but you know what? Go check out the Bisons, because this is their last year before they move into the Investors Group field.
That's right. It's been a windy year, though.
Yep.
It has been. Might not be ready for another 2 years.
It has been a windy year. Speaking of windy, last night at Can-Am Stadium, it was a windy and cold night.
Is Drew not the master of the segue?
Yeah, it's a good segue.
Thank you.
It's funny, because Drew actually goes around town in a segue.
I drive a segue. It's true. Yeah, I sold my car, just drive a segue up and down the block now. Dog finds it really awkward.
especially because you're on the leash.
Yeah. last night at Canadian Stadium, the Bombers, you know,
it's a good game.
It was a good game. And I'm thankful it was a good game, because it's one thing to sit out there and freeze and have them lose. But the fact that they were able to win made the frostbite a little bit more palatable.
Right. And, you know, the season that they've had.
Yeah.
Drew and I, obviously, if you listen to the show, you know this is our second year of being season.
It's our
second and last.
I think it's our third year.
That's our second.
Pretty sure it's our third.
Second. Next year's our third. You know.
That's a big assumption.
We sit beside, obviously, the people beside us. And
I would hope you sit beside the people beside you.
No, sorry. I meant to say the people that sit beside us are also season ticket holders. And the woman and I were cheering so loud yesterday when the Bombers were. The game was tied.
That was just for when they came by with beer.
No, the game was tied in the second half. And we were cheering so loudly. You know, our entire row was high-fiving. you know, because it was a pretty cold night and the season, you know, the Bombers are 2-9. But
her husband looked a little off put when you started hugging her, though, I got to tell you.
But in all seriousness, though, we were saying, like, this is our Grey Cup. I mean, the Bombers still have they're a long shot to make the playoffs. Obviously, 6 of 8 teams in the CFL make the playoffs. But really, the excitement, and it wasn't a sellout. It was the first game of the year that wasn't a sellout. It was a pretty entertaining game. You know, Buck Pierce comes back after having not played in 2 months.
I'll tell you what, a tonic for a bad offensive football team is playing against the Hamilton Tiger Cats.
Yeah.
Because the Hamilton Tiger Cats are a terrible defensive team, and they're stupid.
The amount of penalties they took last night.
They had 17 penalties last night for, I think, 135 yards, something like that. I can pull up the exact stats right now. But, you know, that's just a dumb football team that the Bombers played against last night. Henry Burris looked awful. I don't know if he couldn't handle the wind or what it was, but I mean, he completed less than 50% of his passes. I think he was 11 of 24 or 11 of 25 or something. Just a poor performance from Henry Burris, and 11 of 24 for 156 yards is what Burris was. And you know, I'm not a big Buck Pierce guy. Personally, I think just... You know, he's too injury prone to really rely on
him. He had his best game of the year last night.
Well, you know, he was very good and he moved the offense, and, you know, and Chad Simpson, you know, 19 carries for 134 yards.
Yep.
You know, when you're running, when your yard per rush is 7.1 yards per rush, it's a good recipe for success. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sort of a cynical bunch at the stadium last night. They sort of have to be there.
I mean, how can you be a fan and not be of this team?
Right. I mean, and so when Alex Brink runs it around right end for the touchdown there, and they finally get that first touchdown in, you know, 3.5 games or whatever it's been.
That's crazy.
In the CFL. Even a garbage time touchdown.
Well, and the thing is, the first half was all field goals last night.
Yeah, it was field goal after field goal. I mean, you know,
at least they didn't punt.
Well, you know, that was a lesson learned, let's say, from that Saskatchewan game. You know, so was it good for the Bombers yesterday? Yes. And was it nice that they won? Yes. Is it a sign of better things to come? I'm not going to go that far at this point in time.
The Bombers are still a team that has question marks at every position, and going forward, you know, at the key positions, quarterback, receiver, there's questions, and the defense isn't as good as it was last year, and they've lost veterans. What? But really, the reality is that they needed that.
Yeah.
The fans needed that, because the reality is people like me and you and the other 25 or 26,000 people that were there yesterday, it's been just a horrible year, going back to what happened with the stadium and, you know, the Paul LaPolice and just everything. So it was one of those little things you'll remember. You'll look back at the season, and hopefully you'll forget the entire season. But, you know, right now, it was one of those little... It was like a little ray of sunshine in an otherwise very, very cloudy and depressing season.
Agreed. It's another ray of sunshine, and a guy that, have to have high hopes for his play. And, you know, you should, considering that he was the first overall draft pick in the CFL draft a couple years ago. Henock Mwamba played a fantastic football game yesterday.
Yep.
He was everywhere. The numbers, I believe, were 5 tackles, 1 sack, 1 forced fumble, and 1 pass knockdown.
Yep.
He was everything you want out of a middle linebacker. You know, the way he patrolled the field, and game by game, as he gets more comfortable in knowing that middle linebacker position is his, and as he gets more confidence, and as he gets, you know, more time, more reps in that position, you can see that he's quickly emerging into a dominant player in the CFL on the defensive side of the ball.
Yep, he's one of those guys that's going to bring swagger back, because this year they haven't had any swagger. And, you know, when you lose guys like Doug Brown, and everybody knows all the guys they lost, Abby Khan, you haven't had a lot to cheer about as far as the Bombers go. In the last couple of weeks, it's just gotten worse. And, you know, Richie's surprise at the fact that the Bombers haven't had an offensive touchdown is well warranted.
CFL. You should have an offensive touchdown.
Yep.
I mean,
Henock Mwamba is one of those guys where you can look at and you're going to say, you know what? He's going to be a Bomber. He's going to be one of those guys that will follow. And the reality is this year, there's been a lot of guys where you wonder, are they going to bring these guys back? You know, Buck Pierce included. And you don't, is this the guy that they're going to take into the new stadium as their quarterback?
And that's the problem. And that's a very good question, Ezzy, because, I mean, you know, when he's healthy, is he a starting quarterback in the CFL? I think the answer is yes.
Yep.
The problem is there's that asterisk that goes next to it.
Right.
And next year, you know, if, you know, new stadium, so you put
My biggest issue is when you come in, isn't anything, when you come in and you have an injury-riddled player quarterback, and then he gets injured, and then you complain about it and say, oh, if we only had him all year, we would have been good.
Acting surprised that the guy who's injury-prone gets injured.
So. CFL is a passing league, and you have to have your quarterback healthy. All the teams in the CFL, you go up and down, Ricky Ray in Toronto, Henry Burris in Hamilton, Calvillo in Montreal. I mean, you have to have an elite quarterback, and the Bombers have one. Well, he's always injured.
No, I don't think they do have one, and I mean, you guys know more about this than I would, but I don't think they do have one, and I watch a fair amount of these games, and I don't think they've had one in a very long time. And it's hard to win at football games when you don't have the best quarterback on the field.
I don't think he's elite. I think he's certainly...
So then this is the problem, Drew, though. If you don't think he's elite, then the question is, do you have elite offensive line, or an elite running back, or elite receivers?
They might have an elite running back. They might have an elite running back if they use him. Okay. But the problem
is... Last night,
you know, ride your horses. I mean,
our problem is if you can't score and you're always down, it's hard to start running all the time.
Admittedly. I mean, I do think that they have an elite running back, and probably, you know, if you took a poll of the general managers in the CFL, I would think that Chad Simpson would finish in the top two or three. Granted, it's only an 18 league, but that he would finish right up at the top, you know, in most polls about the most dangerous running backs you have to scheme against. You see him on the field, and you can see he's an NFL talent who probably won't get back to the NFL simply because he's going to cost too much for an NFL team based on the salary cap and the fact that he's a veteran player.
Elite in other places. I mean, you have to make up for it, right?
Yep. Right. They've got work to do. Whoever, you know, we're expecting Joe Mack to not be around next year, whoever replaces him has a lot of work to do.
And the problem is, I don't know how you acquire an elite quarterback. I don't know
What do you about developing one?
Well, I haven't seen...
Didn't Calgary and BC do it?
Yeah, Calgary and BC do it year after year.
They always do it?
Yeah.
And that was one thing we had. We never had, Kahari Jones, Kevin Glenn, we never had the
Kahari
elite quarterbacks.
Kahari Jones was not an elite quarterback.
No, that's what I'm saying. We always had good running backs. Roberts.
And elite wide receivers. Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. You need to have... But if you're the Bombers board, it's quite simple. In most other leagues, it's a copycat league.
Yeah.
What makes BC successful right now?
They're strong at quarterback.
So
good wide receivers.
Look at the structure of the organization, and you copy it, because clearly what's happening here doesn't work.
Right.
It's not rocket science.
No, exactly.
Maybe you have too many voices on the board, but somebody or most of them have to learn and figure out, okay, what makes a successful franchise? What doesn't? Well, they can tell you what doesn't. They got to figure out what does, and they got to use, and they got to copy it.
You're absolutely right. You look at the model franchises, and the Bombers should be a model franchise because of the fan support that they have.
For sure.
Because besides Winnipeg and Saskatchewan, those two fan bases are so far and away better than every other one in the league. But you're right. The BC Lions are a model franchise in everything from their front office structure to their on-field actions. Wally Buono retires. They bring in Mike Benavidez because they have a plan in place, and they don't skip a beat. They don't skip a beat because
they've skipped a couple beats in Winnipeg over the years.
It's been over the last 20 years, I would suggest.
Well, and there's no plan.
There's no long-term succession plan. You're absolutely right. They go from coach to coach to coach. And there's no continuity.
Paying three coaches right now, right?
What's that?
Paying three coaches right now.
Are they still paying Doug Barry?
Mike Kelly.
Jeff Reinbold, I think.
Coach.
Yeah, and Mike Kelly. Yeah. I mean,
they're not paying Joe Pow still, are they?
I'm not sure. He might be the new offensive coordinator next year.
I was a big fan of Joe Pow.
He was a good guy.
Just common sense. You know, how do you get better, and what are you trying to try and do?
You
to get
don't
better?
Have to reinvent the wheel. And the wheel's been invented somewhere else. Just
course,
copy it.
And trying to sell it as something else. Don't make promises. Just deliver. Okay.
It's pretty straightforward.
It's a lot easier that way.
Let's go to break. When we come back, we shift to baseball. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. 2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, where unfortunately, thanks to this lockout, not a lot of hockey to talk. But we're thrilled to welcome to the program Richard Griffin from the Toronto Star to talk about the Toronto Blue Jays. We're big baseball fans here. We thought we'd reach out to Richard as he is the Blue Jays expert. Richard, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
No problem. There was a little hockey going on here in Tampa last night. Guy Boucher threw out the first pitch and used a Chris Pronger stick to fire a strike from the rubber. That was pretty good.
Well,
the only hockey we're going to see for a while.
Yeah, I think that's about it. You know, so maybe he'll go on a barnstorming tour and throw out first pitches everywhere. Richard, as you wrote about in your blog, you wrote about in your blog yesterday on the Toronto Star, there was some confusion about Yunil Escobar and his return to the Jays lineup. Of course, he was suspended for 3 games for his gay slur that he wrote in his eye black. He was supposed to be back in the lineup yesterday. They decided not to, they pulled him out of the lineup. What do you think happened behind the closed doors between Escobar and Jays manager John Farrell that made the team change his mind?
Well, after the Tuesday press conference, he flew on Wednesday morning to Florida and met the team yesterday for the first time. And I have a feeling that when he sat down in the office with John Farrell that John didn't like the way that he was speaking of, the whole situation and his remorse and moving forward. And he decided to give him another day. And it's not a case of he hadn't been involved, because there's plenty of times during a season. I mean, it's played every day. There's plenty of times where players have 2 days off. Either they're nicked up with an injury or they're just sat and come back. So that wasn't the issue. It was something more than that. And in a way, I admire Farrell for doing that and not just knee-jerk bringing him back to the lineup because he's eligible.
Richard, sticking with Escobar, on a scale of 1 to 10, how poorly do you think this situation was handled by the Blue Jays? 1 being bad and 10 being good.
1 being good?
Pardon me, sorry, 1 being bad and 10 being good. Sorry about that.
Oh, I'd say that it was a 2. It was just, first of all, Paul Beeston should have been there in New York, not Alex Anthopoulos. It's not a player personnel issue. It's an organization issue, a community issue, a societal issue, and that's bigger than a GM. And that didn't happen. I'm not so sure that that no one saw the eye black. I was down in the dugout yesterday and was looking John Farrell in the eye as we were doing the pregame scrum, pregame discussion. And if he had had something written under his eyes, I certainly would have been able to read it. It's a very closed space. There's a lot of Latin presence on this team. So, the fact that he's often had stuff written on his eye black over the years, that's no excuse. And I think the press conference was not handled well, and the main thing being Beeston should have been there.
Richard, moving away from Escobar and over to third base, Brett Lowry, obviously much talked about. He's only 22 years old, but there's been a lack of power from him this year, and obviously there's still room to grow. But what do you think the reason is for that lack of power, being homers, doubles, and just driving the ball?
Well, I was talking specifically with Farrell about that yesterday, and the fact that a man of his strength and ability and bat speed is unable to drive more than 9 home runs for the season. And he said it's just a matter of slowing him down, which is his problem in all aspects of the game and even mentally, just slowing him down, bringing him back to the speed of the game. And a lot of times players say, well, the game's faster than I thought. Well, this game is slower than Lurie's amped up, persona. And what happens is, as Farrell explained, his lower body is like the rest of him, and it gets out front and steals all of the power that normally would be generated in a normal home run hitter's swing. And that's something that he has to work on, that they have to work on with him in the off season, next spring training. And it's something that should be ironed out, because the rest of his game is pretty good. Third base defensively, he's he could be as good as it gets in the American League after a couple of seasons. It's just he is 22, as you pointed out, and there's a lot to learn.
You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. We're joined by Richard Griffin of the Toronto Star. Richard, the Jays have a ton of young talent. Another one of those young players is an outfielder named Anthony Gose. They acquired him from the Houston Astros in exchange for Brett Wallace a number of years ago. What do you see as his future with the Blue Jays?
Well, again, there's been a lot of players come up this season in baseball, in Major League Baseball, and succeed at 19, 20, 21. The Jays haven't seemed to be that lucky, and I think that a lot of that has to do with the way that they baby their players in the minor leagues, that they don't push them as much. as other organizations do. And a guy like Anthony Ghost has a tremendous arm, but he came up and he couldn't throw. You know, his throwing was his timing and his footwork weren't that good, so they've been working on that with him. His technique at the plate was a minor league level. They've been working on keeping both hands on the bat, staying with pitches and going the other way. And so that's stuff that you know, maybe should have been worked on in the minor leagues, but they want players to fail before they succeed so that they're more accessible to learning the proper way of doing things. So Ghost has a chance to be the starting left fielder next year, but if they want to win, then it's going to be very difficult for them to think about having Travis d'Arnaud behind the plate and think about having Echevarria at second base and think about having Ghost in left field. They're going to have to go out in the wintertime and sign some veterans for at least two of those positions.
Richard, you mentioned Adany Echevarria. Sorry, that's a hard name to pronounce. He's a shortstop that the Blue Jays have called up from AAA, and he's gone into about 30 games. What do you like about his potential with the Blue Jays going forward?
Well, he is everything that they suggested defensively. He gets behind ground balls where other players are backhanding and reaching for ground balls. Gets behind him, has a nice, smooth throwing motion. And offensively, he has a chance to be a good hitter. He gets better at every level that he goes to. Had a slow start when he came up to the majors, but, you know, his average is now at 250, and that's coming from well below 200. And I think that if the Jays want to help their pitching staff next year, they need better than Kelly Johnson at second base in terms of range, in terms of turning the double play. And I think that that's a guy that they could carry defensively and watch him develop offensively. And if they did carry him, it would be tough for Ghost to make the team as a left fielder.
Richard, you mentioned pitching. Obviously, it's been ravaged by injuries this year, but there's a lack of veteran presence there. Do you see the Jays dipping into the free agent market for anybody like, you know, Zach Greinke, even former Jay, Sean Markham? Obviously, it's not a great list when you look at the free agent crop after the season, but do you see them hopping in there and spending on a couple of guys?
Well, I think that as much as going into that, as you said, shallow free agent pool, they might go and make a deal for a trade using some of their talent at the minor league level, looking for guys that that can jump right into the top three in the rotation. You know, there's guys like Irvin Santana. There's guys that have option years that might not be picked up by their teams. Jake Peavy has been mentioned.
Yep.
But definitely it was Paul Beeston who first came out and said that we are going to spend money, we are going to move forward. And when you look at the American League postseason race this year for the teams and going to the National League, a lot of the teams finished under 500 last year and are now in playoff position. So it's not something that's impossible for the Jays to envision.
John Farrell, the manager of the Blue Jays, obviously came to the Jays from Boston, where he was their pitching coach. Boston is a team in turmoil, even more so than the Jays are. Do you think that John Farrell is the manager of the Jays in 2013, and how would you rate his performance through the past two seasons?
Well, I'd say I'd rate his performance a C-minus, using a school scale. You know, he has not been a leader, an inspiration to his players. He's done what management has wanted him to do. You know, he finished at 500 last year, going to be well below this year. There's been a lot of situations that have gone on in the clubhouse, the latest being Escobar. I think that might change the Red Sox mind. I mean, they had their own situation at the end of last season. They don't need to go after a manager who had situations similar to that in terms of being disruptive within the clubhouse. So, yeah, I think he will be the manager in 2013. I don't think there was any advantage for John Farrell to dismiss any of those rumors, because all it can do by letting the rumors perpetuate is get him more money somewhere, either with the Jays or with the Red Sox. So I don't think he really had an intention of pursuing a Red Sox job, but if they're going to talk about him, he's going to let them. And all it's going to do is get him a better contract wherever he stays, and I think it's going to be here.
Richard, final question. Greg Zahn obviously went off about the squad this year, this week. He said a number of things, but one of the things that caught my attention was the mention of the lack of maybe accountability in the clubhouse. Do you think that's a big issue and that veteran presence is needed to kind of settle things down a bit?
Well, I think it has been a big issue ever since Jose Bautista was hurt and left the team. I mean, he was that veteran presence and you know, had control of the young Latin players or the younger Latin players, had control of the American players, and was, you know, he was an influence in that clubhouse. So I don't think you need to go out and get someone else. I think his presence was sorely missed in the last month and a half since he left town. And, you know, you walk in there and it seems like a lost clubhouse. There's no focal point. There's no lightning rod in there, and I think he can be that.
Richard Griffin from the Toronto Star, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon.
Okay, guys, anytime.
Take care, Richard. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the program. A big thank you to Richard Griffin of the Toronto Star. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Subscribe and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. While you're at it, you can follow us on Twitter, at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. We welcome Michael Remus back to the microphone as we're going to talk baseball.
Remo. And
Remo is a very big Seattle Mariners fan. It's probably been some slim pickings for the Mariners the last number of years there, Remo.
I'll tell you, when they were in the ALCS 2 years in a row in 2000 and 2001, and they were on national TV, I remember racing home from school in the afternoon to watch their playoff games.
You want me to go old school?
Sure.
When I used to babysit Remus,
back
in the day, I was babysitting.
Whoa. Hang on.
Beep, beep.
Hang on. You used to babysit Remus?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
True story.
And I was there the night that Griffey slid home against the Yanks.
So, I mean, it has been...
Watched it on his TV in his kitchen, in the corner.
It's been pretty tough the last few years, but I remember the good old days, and I'm clinging on to the 116-win season in 2001.
Didn't they lose in the first round that year to the White Sox?
No, they narrowly beat the White Sox, but lost. They lost 2 years in a row to the Yankees.
Okay.
Curse Jim Leyritz, I think.
Was Jay Buhner on the team that year?
Which team? He was on the Yankees and the Mariners.
Yeah.
Jay Buhner, I don't know if good he was in 2001.
Yeah. Frank Costanza being upset when George Steinbrenner goes to, forget it.
That R.A.
How can you trade Jay Buhner?
Yeah, exactly.
That R.A. Dickey's got a heck of an arm.
Obviously, there's about 11 games or so left in the regular season. The AL is sort of beginning to take shape more than the NL as the playoff picture is going to look, and we'll talk about the NL coming up at 2:45. The Yankees have a one-game lead on the Orioles in the AL East, the shocking Baltimore Orioles. Nobody saw that coming. But even if the Orioles don't win the AL East, they're in a good position to get one of those two wild card spots. The White Sox have a game and a half lead on the Tigers in the AL Central. Whoever wins that division is going, you know, nobody in that division is eligible for the wild card, really. They're eligible, but they're not close enough
right,
to it.
Not close enough.
Texas is four games up on Oakland. Texas is, you know, got the best record in the AL this year so far.
Nobody's really driving and going away with it. That's the thing. Like, it's right. the winner right now is the leader right now has 89 wins.
That's right. The Rangers have a 593 winning percentage, which isn't dominant by any stretch of the imagination in baseball. The A's are four games back of the Rangers, but they're tied with the Orioles for that wild card. Pardon me, they're 1-2 in that wild card. Do you like that new wild card format where both teams make the wild card and play against each other?
Love it.
It's great. Why not? Make them play. Make it a little bit harder for the wild card team to get in.
But do you
also
like it
include
in
one more team.
A one game format?
Absolutely.
Though?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a risk that you will lose that one game, but you haven't earned. They're in the right to have a five game series to begin with. I'm fine with it.
Reem,
go ahead.
I'm going to agree with Richard too. Actually, at first you think kind of devalues the playoffs, but the playoffs you play 162 games. We've seen the one game playoffs the last few years that have been the San Diego Colorado a few years ago was one of the most exciting games. It puts more emphasis on winning the division, and you know you got to play for that right to get into playoffs. I like it.
Yeah, and especially in a year where you have two teams that really weren't expected to compete, Oakland A's and Baltimore Orioles being the big surprises in the American League. Now both of those teams can get in.
That's right.
It's great. And you play 162 games in baseball, so it's better to have more teams and have more meaningful games. There's absolutely so many good pennant races now.
Think about it right now. I mean, obviously, sure, it'd be a one-game difference, but in the NL, the Braves would be running away with it. There'd be no race. What would we be talking about there? It's way better for the game. There's too many. There's 30 teams. I like. Obviously, they're moving to 15-15 next year for the AL and NL.
The Houston Astros moving over to the to the American League West,
and they're finally doing some good. They're doing some good things. I like the way that the game's moving.
The two most surprising teams. I mean, at the beginning of the year, you pick the usual teams to be in the playoffs. The Los Angeles Angels, who are 3.5 games out of the wild card. Tampa Bay has been good for the last number of years. The Red Sox, obviously, they've had a disaster of a season. You look at the AL wild card right now. You have the Baltimore Orioles and the Oakland Athletics, two teams that nobody would have predicted to be in the running this late into the season. If they play in the wild card, only one of those teams is going to go on into the divisional series in the AL. Do you think either of those two teams have a real shot at doing anything in the playoffs, or are they just going to end up being first-round fodder for one of the division winners?
I think I actually like the A's team. I don't think the Orioles are very good. They've obviously played above their head. I think they've
A negative run differential, a -8 run differential, for a team with a negative run differential to be in a playoff spot at the moment is almost unheard of.
That's right. And you look at negative run differential, I think they've won about 14 or 15 extra inning games in a row, and their record in one run games, which is basically a coin toss, is like 20-4 or something like that. What I like about the A's is they play at their home park in Oakland. I forget what it's called right now, Oakland Coliseum.
Yeah.
It's a huge ballpark that plays well to their strengths of pitching. Brett Anderson just came back from Tommy John surgery. Very good pitcher, high strikeout, low walk.
Injured again, though.
And is he injured again?
Yeah.
Okay, well, Brandon McCarthy, hopefully he comes back. He got hit in the head, but he's...
Probably the scariest, thing that happened in sports in the last little while. He had to have brain surgery to relieve the pressure in his skull after getting hit by a line drive.
And then Tommy Malone, I like his arm. He's got... doesn't walk many guys, strikes out, mid-range strikeout, but he keeps the ball in the park. And the other guy, A.J. Griffin, another
Jared
young
up-and-comer.
Oh, and Jared Parker.
I mean, you have young pitching. It's not as dominant as it was in those old Moneyball A's days. But it's good, and it's five deep.
And they just churn it out year after year after year. I mean, the Oakland A's, remember, this is a team that traded Gio Gonzalez in the offseason.
For a boatload of prospects.
Admittedly, but that's what they have to do each and every year.
Brett Anderson has a grade 2 oblique strain, is done for the regular season. They hope that he returns for the playoffs.
Well, anywho, they picked up Stephen Drew on shortstop.
Great pickup for them.
Is a guy who always hit but could never really stay healthy. And Seth Smith is a guy who I've liked. He's, hitting 3-4.
And these are cast. I mean, Stephen Drew was a big prospect in Arizona, never really panned out.
Brandon Moss. I mean, it's a bunch of it's a hodgepodge of
Seth
guys.
Smith is from Colorado, going back a number of years ago.
Lefty batter. He's got a good batting eye. Walks a lot. Has good on-base percentage. But the one guy, we haven't mentioned is Josh Reddick, who they acquired from the Red Sox, who really was a throw-in for a trade with Ryan Sweeney. And Josh Reddick's, gone beyond anyone's expectation. I think he's got something like 25 home runs and been huge for them.
Was he not in that Bailey deal?
I was going to say, wasn't he in the Bailey deal?
Oh, yeah. Is like Ryan Sweeney and Andrew Bailey for Josh Reddick. Was that the trade?
Right.
But no, I didn't even think the Red Sox expected Reddick.
They didn't.
No, because Josh Reddick on the Red Sox was sort of a utility infielder.
Outfielder.
Sort of outfielder, utility outfielder, who never really got a lot of playing time on the Red Sox.
Because, they came into the season, the Red Sox, with Crawford and with Ellsbury, and there wasn't as much room, and then Ellsbury went down with the injury the whole year. Crawford's been out with his problems, and now he's out for the season, obviously. Yeah, it was Sweeney with Reddick, and there's a bunch of others for the Bailey deal. But you know what? I'm with Remus there. Baltimore does have a little of that feeling, Ezzy, when you get like that momentum. That's the one thing.
Confidence.
The confidence, momentum. And sometimes, Remus, you get lucky in those one-run games, but that luck continues. You just ride it all the way.
Yeah.
And Baltimore can mash a bit more, and that's the thing. So the question is it pitching? Oakland loses McCarthy, and they lose Anderson, but Baltimore can mash more. So it's going to be interesting.
Especially in a one-game situation for that final.
I think you're asking even past that, too, though.
Well, of course, I am asking past that. But, I mean, in a one game, if Baltimore and Oakland have to play each other for one game in order to get on to the divisional playoffs, it's hard to go up. I think it's hard to discount Oakland's pitching.
I think, but Baltimore actually also has good. I think Zach Britton's pitched very well for them.
Yeah.
Miguel Gonzalez has come out, and Wei Yin Chen and Chris Tillman, who they got from the Mariners with Adam Jones also. Adam Jones having a huge year for Baltimore, and I'm
Adam Jones was a stud. He was going to be a stud. I mean, everybody knew he was going to be a stud, and then this Seattle, for some reason, traded him.
The Markakis injury is bad for Baltimore. That certainly hurts them. But they've had great play from all their guys. They've had big seasons from guys like Chris Davis and Wieters back behind the plate, and guys have all reached their potential. A crazy year from Jim Johnson.
That Coco Crisp can really run.
At the end of the day, is this still the Texas Rangers league to win? Are they still going to be? Do you think they're going to be the AL representative in the World Series for a third straight year?
I think it's hard to argue with the Rangers lineup. If Josh Hamilton, can play the way he can, sometimes he goes into slumps where, his average, dips and he strikes out too much. But they do have, Nelly Cruz had a big postseason for them last year. Ian Kinsler, Adrian Beltre, who is one of the best, defensive third basemen in the league. And also his hitting has been pretty underrated the last few years. You never know. I think it's for the Rangers. The question is about their pitching.
That's right.
I can't believe, Reem, you're not even talking about the Yankees and your old boy Ichiro Suzuki. I think you can never count the Yankees out with all of the talent. They spent $250 million on the roster, and they've been in first place in the AL East. So I don't know. I know the Texas Rangers are a good up-and-coming team in there. Obviously winning the AL Central, but I don't think you can ever count out the Yankees.
You can't count out the Yankees simply really because of the hitting that they have. I mean, you look at their pitching, and their pitching, really their best pitcher right now is Kuroda, I would think.
Well, Sabathia looked good yesterday.
Yeah, but he's been he has had his injury problems this year.
But he came back yesterday and looked great.
But from day one this year right through today, Kuroda's been the most consistent.
Pettit's back, and he's looking good now. It's true, but all they care about who's back for the playoffs. You're going to throw out Sabathia. You're going to throw out Pettit. You're going to throw out an insane lineup. I mean, it's hard to say it's not going to be that the Yankees aren't going to have a huge say in this matter.
I'll just say that the Arizona Diamondbacks showed in 2001 that you really need only two starting pitchers in the playoffs.
Right there.
And, C.C. Sabathia may not be healthy now, but the guy is a tank. He's going to come in the playoffs, yep. And he'll be straight.
And
guys
doesn't Pettit's injury actually help them because he's fresh for the playoffs?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right. Andy Pettit is a guy that, you have to be very concerned about the wear and tear on his body.
But it depends also who you play. If you draw Oakland, for example.
Mm-hmm. It's not a very good hitting team.
Exactly. So it's a different... Right. It's exactly...
Hey, I know that much.
Yeah. I mean, and Andy Pettit's the kind of guy, you don't know how he does it. He does it... It seems like it's through smoke and mirrors, but year in, year out, he always seems
because
to...
Because if Oakland wins the wild card, then they can't... Is it still... I assume the rule is still you can't play in your division?
I don't want to say for sure. I'm not 100%
sure. Well, ask Remus about that one, because if that's the case, or Jonah might know that, because if that's the case, then they'll play the Yankees, because the Yankees have a better record than the Central.
That's a good first-round draw.
Yeah, I mean, well, and and nobody's really giving much credit to whoever's going to win in the AL Central.
But why, though? I don't know why. I mean, the Sox can't throw out some good arms there?
Yeah, they can.
Or the Tigers can throw out Verlander and Cabrera and boys?
Yeah.
Baseball has really reached parity without a salary cap. That's the best part.
It's wide open. It's almost as wide open as it's ever been.
And it's reached parity because of no salary cap, because the people in charge are smarter than they used to be.
Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the program. I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. And we're pleased to welcome to the program, you know him from his work on Grantland.com. He's also the author of the national bestseller, The Extra 2%, How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. Jonah Carey. Jonah, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no hockey. I see how it is. I'm the sloppy seconds. I see what's going on.
You would never say that. Jonah, how are you this afternoon?
I'm great. An exciting time, really, for Toronto Maple Leafs fans, because this is the first year in 50 years that their team won't humiliate them. That's really just so wonderful. Good for them, and that's great.
You still a Habs fan?
I am a Habs fan, of course. Anytime I could dump on the Leafs, it's great. Listen, the Habs have only won zero cups in the last 19 years, too, but the Leafs haven't won a cup since 95 years before I was born, so it's great.
Jonah, we had Richard Griffin of the Toronto Star on earlier in the program talking about the Blue Jays. From your perspective, what do the Blue Jays have to do to compete for a playoff position next season?
Spend money would be a good start. And any team that claims that they can't spend money is full of it. It's kind of one of my crusades, and I'm probably going to write about it in the near future. A lot of money is going to come into this sport. Every team is already making a profit. Let's start with that. Everybody who says they're making a loss, they're not making a loss. Everybody's making money, and it's great. Now we're going to get an extra $45 million per team between the ESPN contract, the TV contract, and the national one with Turner and the other partners. So $45 million off the top for every team, on top of all the profits everybody's making, it's just huge. And if, the Jays haven't flat out come out and said, Alex Anthopoulos has said, yeah, we have no money, But there needs to be some aggressive steps taken. Now, it is the case that there are only a certain number of free agents. You can't just make up money. You can't pay a lousy player $20 million a year. But there will be very good talent out there, and the Jays, it would behoove them to go out and get it.
Jonah, a lot of the articles that you write for Grantland involve stats and advanced stats. Can you explain why the AL Central race has been very much determined by what the stat guys call regression to the mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So regression to the mean, it's a simple concept. It basically means everything is going great for you. There's a pretty good chance that you're going to run into a little bit of bad luck. It's going to start to even out. Or if everything is going poorly, there's a pretty good chance that it's going to even out and you'll start to do better. Unless, of course, you're the Toronto Maple Leafs. But you continue this trend and it keeps going with regression to the mean. And we're looking at defense in this way. That's what's been the real key for the AL Central. Talk about the Chicago White Sox. They had a pretty good team last year, but two of their guys, Alex Rios and Adam Dunn, were not faring very well. In fact, they were having miserable seasons. Dunn, one of the worst seasons in the history of baseball, and Rios not far behind. And they've been better this year. You know, they're playing better and they're hitting better, and that's been a big key. But also their defense has been much better, and it was probably a little bit below what you would expect. The Tigers, conversely, their defense has really been a big problem. That's one of the big reasons they haven't been good. But the other reason is the guys, aside from the superstars, they have five really good players on that team. Miguel Cabrera, Prince Fielder, Justin Verlander, Max Scherzer, Austin Jackson. The other 20 guys stink to varying degrees. And we've seen that happen this year where some of those guys were really good last year. Alex Avila, Johnny Peralta were very good players, all-stars, in fact. And they've come back to the pack. It turns out that Alex Avila is not an elite player, which who would have thought that? You know, I mean, it's just you could have seen this coming, I guess. But many of the Sharps did not, and many of the fans did not. And this is where we're at now. The White Sox are in position to win the division, and the Tigers were overrated by everybody because you looked at it and said, well, they won 95 games at Prince Fielder. Obviously, they're going to win 100. But it doesn't really work that way. They got very lucky, and a lot of the aggression has really hit them very hard this year.
Jonah, Steven Strasburg obviously is a talking point for all baseball fans. You had a colleague at Grantland read about the fact that the Nationals did not handle this matter really properly and that injury risk has been minimized so much over the years that the Nationals could really have him pitching right now in some ways. Can you talk about that and whether or not you agree with that sentiment?
I do. The guy who wrote it is a guy named Rainey Gisserli, and he is...
I knew that's who wrote it, but I did not know how to pronounce his name, and I didn't want to risk it.
No problem. That's totally fine, Gisserli. It's not easy to pronounce. He would be the first one to tell you. He's exactly like me, by the way. We're about the same height. We talk with our hands. We talked about jointly running for president because we share the same views on pretty much everything. He's a great guy. Despite the fact that I'm Canadian, I would not be able to vote to run. But a great guy, and also he's the inventor of a stat called Pitcher Abuse Points. Him, along with a guy named Keith Woolner, invented it for Baseball Prospectus. Mm-hmm. What is Pitcher Abuse Points? It was a thing created in the late 90s, and it basically talked about how managers were just running their pitchers out there, especially young guys, over and over and over again, and you were building up stress on arms, and guys were getting injured. I don't want to say that Rainey was single-handedly responsible for pitch counts and everything that's happened since then, but I think it was sort of part of that movement, where now every manager, every pitching coach knows what's going on. The broadcasters are saying, well, we're in the fourth inning and he's on a 75th pitch. You better watch that because you're going to have to come out of the game. We've become much more cognizant of it. And so when the Nationals are coming out and saying, we have to shut this guy down, that is an overreaction to something that's already in play. In other words, Strasburg has already been, you know, closely taken care of throughout these last few years, because everybody's aware of pitch counts and watching for young pitchers and so forth, and yet the Nationals are taking an additional step and they're saying, well, we're going to be hyper-careful. Fine, you know, it's a big investment. Strasburg, they hope that he's going to be there for years to come. But the bottom line is that D.C. hasn't had a championship team, hasn't had a playoff team since 1933. Now they've got a playoff team. Right. They've got a chance to go all the way. They're still a very good team without Strasburg. The guy who's going to replace him in the rotation is either going to be someone like Edwin Jackson. I guess Russ Deadweiler would be the guy that would replace him, right. Actually. He was the fifth starter. He's great. You know, so it's not a huge loss, but Strasburg is, you know, objectively one of the five best pitchers on earth, and you're putting him on the sideline. So I think that it's pretty simple. I mean, I think it's an overreaction to a hypothetical situation where maybe pitching him more will get hurt versus an actual situation where it is objectively the case that if you put Strasburg on your bench, your team is now worse.
You're listening to TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca, and we're joined by Jonah Carey. He's the lead baseball writer for Grantland.com.
Jonah, Mike Trout is obviously having a phenomenal rookie year. Do you think he's going to be the clear winner over Miguel Cabrera for the MVP? And do you think that maybe the triple threat crown is the biggest thing standing in his way? I should mention Cabrera's going for the triple threat crown. Do you think him going for the triple threat crown is probably the biggest thing standing in Trout's way?
You know, I'm reluctant to comment on how I think people will vote, because that's a tough thing to do. You're talking about, first of all, it's a specific group of voters, and I don't know who the MVP voters are this year specifically. I mean, I know a lot of the members of the Baseball Writers Association of America, but I don't know specifically who are the 20 people or whatever, the 50 people that are voting, and so it's hard for me to comment specifically on that. And even beyond that, it's hard to know what's in somebody's heart. I could tell you who I think should win the MVP, which is absolutely Mike Trout. If Miguel Cabrera wins the Triple Crown, Mike Trout should still win the MVP. Mike Trout has been objectively better than Miguel Cabrera. It's hard to say that when a guy is going to potentially lead the league in batting average and home runs and RBIs, but batting average and home runs and RBIs are just three components of the game. You have to look at defense and base running, hitting doubles and stealing bases and drawing walks and not making errors and getting to balls. So there's a million things that go into playing baseball, and Mike Trout is incredible at all of them. Miguel Cabrera is very good at certain things, but he's not good at everything. Mike Trout is literally good at everything. I mean, so his season, even missing the first 22 games of the year, by the way, it's just unbelievable. You know, the all-around skills are tremendous. And it's not a referendum on Cabrera's career. You know, he hasn't won MVP yet, so maybe we should reward him. Or, oh, is it too soon to give Trout an MVP because he's a rookie, whatever. These are just dumb narratives. The bottom line is Trout has provided more value to his team than Miguel Cabrera, even if Miguel Cabrera wins the Triple Crown. Therefore, Mike Trout should be the MVP.
Flipping it to the National League, is it Ryan Braun for MVP in that league?
I think it's wide open, to be honest with you. I see a lot of good candidates in the National League. I think Andrew McCutchen was the guy for a while. He sort of faded. I look at two of the catchers as being really good candidates. I really like what Buster Posey's done this year, and I really like what Yadier Molina has done this year. And, you know, the catch-all stat that's really gained a lot of traction in the statistical world is called wins above replacement, WAR.
Mm-hmm.
WAR doesn't really do a good job with catchers. It doesn't quite know what to do with catchers because catching defense is complicated. We're starting to learn more about how catchers frame pitches, for instance, and how it could save pitchers lots of runs and so forth. Sort of an old-school concept that we could never put into numbers until very recently. I also think that WAR, well, I don't think, I know, WAR takes into account playing time. Well, Yadier Molina and Buster Posey can't play 162 games because they're catchers. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. You can't catch every day. And so I think that it tends to underrate them a little bit, too. But you look at their impact on a game-by-game basis, and they're not playing 90 games. They're still going to play 130, 140. On a game-by-game basis, those guys do so much to affect the course of play between their defense and between the fact that they're very good offensive players. Molina, more batting average kind of guy, but Posey hitting for power and a very tough part to hit for power. Very, very tough part. You know, driving in runs, hitting in the middle of the lineup. High batting average, high on base, does everything very well. So, you know, to be honest with you, I would be okay with any of those four guys winning the MVP. I think that Braun might be the leader right now in wins above replacement. It's close.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if I had to cast a ballot today, I'd have to give serious thought to both Posey and Molina. Tremendous seasons for both guys.
Jonah, the Red Sox have obviously been a complete disaster this year. With more money coming to them and having more flexibility in the payroll, what do you think they're going to do to address the fact that, you know, they have lots of holes on their roster?
Well, I mean, they always make a huge profit. I mean, there's $45 million per team. It's not all that relevant to the Red Sox. They make just an insane amount of money from the NESN network, their regional sports network. So that's not really the problem. The problem is, you know, you could talk about the Jays. The Jays might be closer to winning than the Red Sox are. They have a lot of good young players, and you could sort of see it coming. The Red Sox are a mess. I mean, they have no pitching staff, really. John Lester and Clay Buchholz, sort of, but Lester's very erratic, and Buchholz gets injured all the time. I have no idea, 3-5, and that's a mystery. And it's hard to rebuild that much. You know, even if you throw a lot of money at the problem, they're just way behind a lot of teams in the AL East. I mean, the Yankees are qualitatively and quantitatively better. I think you could say that about the Rays, even though they've had a little bit of a disappointing season. The Orioles are obviously a great story, and they're going to have a full year of Dylan Bundy and Manny Machado next year. They're going to be pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And the Jays, too. I think the Red Sox might be the worst team in that division right now, not just by record, but by sort of outlook, near-term outlook. Yes, you can spend money and address that problem, but let's say they go out and get, I don't know, Zach Greinke and Anibal Sanchez in the offseason. Well, that certainly helps their pitching staff, but I'm not sure that makes them the best team in that division anyway. I'm not sure it makes them a playoff team. So you sort of have to be thinking about it both ways. Generally speaking, I want teams to spend more money. I hate the idea of poor mouthing and, oh, we're losing money, we can't afford it, da-da-da-da-da. But But I think that's more germane for a team that's like one or two players away and really is a good chance. Tampa Bay, I put in that category. The Pittsburgh Pirates obviously showed something this year. I'd like to see them spend some money. I think you could say that about the Jays. The Red Sox are a mess. The Red Sox have to just overturn that roster to a certain extent. Part of that will be spending money, but I think part of that will be giving playing time to young guys and sort of figuring out where they're at. If you're asking me when I think the Red Sox will be good again, my guess is 2014 is more likely than 2013.
Johnny, you mentioned young players, and your colleague Rainey, who we spoke about earlier, had a really good article, I think it was back in December, about prospects and how the teams have kind of moved to maybe even overrating these prospects. Do you agree with that sentiment? Because it seems like, you know, for example, I think everybody in this room, as Canadian, we're Blue Jays fans. We're not Expos fans, we're Blue Jays fans. But you hear a lot about the young players, and then the young players come up, and it seems like you hear so much about them. They get up, and then there's a ceiling put on how good they can be, almost a ceiling that makes it seem like they're pretty replaceable if you put out a reasonable contract offer to a free agent. What's your thoughts on all that?
Well, it's a complicated issue. The thing about prospects is they are overrated to a certain extent in that everything is promised. Before they come up, the sky's the limit. Who knows? They could be the next Mike Trout. And then they play 20 games, and you're like, well, yeah, I guess the guy's not that good. Yeah. That's sort of an overreaction to the overreaction because, for instance, Brad Laurie, I guess, is the classic example. I think Brad Laurie's going to be a very good baseball player. He is merely a pretty good baseball player right now, and people were expecting the world, though, he's going to, you know, tear down mountains right away. That's very unusual. Mike Trout is a once in a 50 years kind of story. People don't perform that way when they're 20 years old. That doesn't happen. It's crazy that it's happening. And, you know, for every guy like that, Ryan Braun was very good out of the chute and so forth, you're going to get 50 guys who struggle a little bit, who it takes time to kind of master all the intricacies of the sport, especially with pitchers, even more than hitters. And so I think all that is going on. Now, having said that, one thing that bugs me is, you know, you get sort of this concern trolling kind of thing going on. So writers will say, and I'll use Tampa Bay as an example. I know a fair bit about them. I've written a book about them. And, you know, David Price is going to get expensive this offseason. Well, David Price is one of the two, three, or four best pitchers in the universe right now. Maybe you'll get these great prospects for David Price, and maybe they'll work out. And the thing about prospects is, if they do hit, then you've got 6 years of game control for each guy, right? Price is going to be available for, I think it's two or three more years before he's a free agent. But the thing is, it's all variables. We don't know how good those prospects were going to be. We don't know if they're going to be good at all. We know for a fact David Price is great. And I think that in the effort to kind of go the other way and say, well, we have to think about efficiency and how are we spending our money and so forth, we sort of lose track of the no-duh factor, which is, hey, wait a minute, David Price, he's awesome. He might win the Cy Young. Maybe he'll make us a better team. Right. I think we lose that. And so when you talk about, you know, the free agents and so forth replacing the young players, yeah, I think there is something to that. I wouldn't go out and try to get a player to replace Brent Laurie. I think he's going to be a good player. I think it'd be very difficult to replace somebody like that, even current Brent Laurie, let alone how good he could become. But I think we have to strike a balance here, too. We don't want to say, well, whatever, take our best veteran, take Jose Bautista, and let's trade him for three prospects and be done. Because Jose Bautista, when he's healthy, hits 40 home runs, and you probably need Jose Bautista on your team.
Joanna, one of my biggest beefs, and I've had it for a while, I talk about it in hockey, and in baseball it applies too, is that of the balanced schedule, or the unbalanced schedule. I know that there's obviously two wild card spots now available, but my contention all along is that you have AL Central teams, generally not very good, can beat up on each other, or really the good teams can beat up on the bad teams, and they have an inherent advantage for that wild card spot over a team like in the AL Eastern, and they're beating each other up. Do you see the league ever moving back to a balanced schedule?
No. I just don't think it's going to happen. Well, I'll tell you what I would do. Not only would I put a balanced schedule in, I would wipe out the division. Right? You know, you mentioned the problem with the balanced schedule, but the alignments are wrong. I mean, it's just not working. If you get rid of the divisions entirely and you match it up like you did in 1968, where you just say this many teams in this league, this many teams in this league, top whatever, make it, well, that's as fair as you can possibly be. It's going to create a little bit of a travel concern, but you could solve that problem by compressing the schedule a little bit, or lengthening the schedule and playing a little deeper. We got global warming anyway. You can play until December. Let's not kid ourselves. So, you know, all these things could happen, and you could change things up if you wanted to. But baseball is loath to change anything. The only thing they like to change is the rule that's existed for decades and decades that determines how you win a batting title. Well, a guy did steroids. We're going to change that. Drop of a hat. They have no problem changing rules when it's expedient to them. But if it's something where everybody in the world thinks that it's obviously wrong, such as a balanced schedule, or an even better example, such as the broken, terrible umpires who make these terrible calls, and we can easily review this stuff, and they're very reluctant to do it, they're not going to do it. Whether it's stubbornness, whether it's tradition, whatever it is, there's just no incentive. They feel like, well, it's a bunch of people screaming on the internet, and we don't really care. When, in fact, you're turning off fans, especially young fans, you grow up and you're 18, 19 years old, and you're watching this stuff, and all you know is technology. You've had a cell phone since you were six, and you know, you've been working on a computer since you were five, and you know all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And we're treating these rules as if it's 1940, and it's just completely foreign to young fans. And if I was a young fan coming up now, baseball's a wonderful sport, but I'd say, you know what? I like the NBA more. I like the NFL more. I like the NHL more. These sports aren't buried in the sand the way baseball is. It's very, very frustrating, and that's why I don't think it's going to change.
Jonah, your new book, it's scheduled to be published in 2014, is the definitive history of the Montreal Expos. That's the 10-year anniversary of the Expos moving out of Montreal, the 20-year anniversary of the 1994 strike that some say crippled the Montreal Expos. Do you ever see a time where Major League Baseball returns to the city of Montreal?
I do not. I think that Major League Baseball will not return to Montreal, not because it's not a viable market. I think it could be a viable market. There's a lot of people there. I think the downtown stadium would have a great effect. There are people with enough wealth to make it happen. I think that there are billionaires within Canada, even outside Canada, maybe somebody who just likes Montreal and would want to move a team there. I think that's possible. I think that there's no problem with the geography of it. You can put them in the Eastern Division. That's all fine. Everything is fine except for Major League Baseball. As far as Major League Baseball is concerned, the Montreal Expos were 30,000 Chernobyls at one time, and they have no incentive to make that happen again. They don't want to even have an inkling of a risk of it. They burned bridges so badly there. They wanted out so badly. It was unbelievable what happened. The end of the 2003 season, they wouldn't allow the Expos to call up players from the minor leagues because they were tied for the wild card. Because if there was any chance in the universe that the Expos could possibly contend for the playoffs, they had to snuff it out. They had to kill it dead. There's no way, given that kind of history, given that kind of legacy, this commissioner, the next commissioner, the next commissioner, the next commissioner's grandson, it's not going to happen for that reason. You would need to have some sort of parallel, bizarro universe where Major League Baseball never existed in Montreal in the first place for Montreal to be considered as a market.
So you're saying there's a chance?
I'm saying there's a chance. Good chance.
Jonah Carey, lead baseball writer for Grantland.com. National bestseller is called The Extra 2%.
Great book.
How Wall Street Strategies Took a Major League Baseball Team from Worst to First. Thanks very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks, Chance. Have a great weekend.
Take care, Jonah. Thanks very much. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live on TSN 1290, tsn1290.ca. Welcome back to the program. A couple minutes to go on this Saturday afternoon. A big thank you to Jonah Carey of Grantland.com. In case you missed any of that interview, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Gentlemen, we're going to give the National League wildcard, or the National League, a little bit of short shrift here, but we'll make up for it next week. You know, you look at the National League's a lot clearer right now than the AL was. The Washington Nationals, they clinched the National League East already. Cincinnati Reds, they clinched the National League Central already. And the San Francisco Giants have a magic number of, I think it's got to be one, as they have a 10-game lead in the National League West right now over the Los Angeles Dodgers. So it comes down to the wild card, really, in the National League. And you look at it, and right now it's the Braves and the Cardinals. They are atop the wild card standings, but only a game and a half back.
The Braves by a considerable margin.
Yeah, the Braves have about a 6-game lead there, so they're pretty much locked
into.
They're in for one of the National League wild card spots. But the Milwaukee Brewers are only a game and a half back of the St. Louis Cardinals for that second wild card, and then even right behind the Brewers are the Dodgers and the Philadelphia. The Philadelphia Phillies are right in the running for that second National League wild card spot also. How do you see that playing out?
Yeah, it's a good question, Drew. Obviously, the Cardinals get Chris Carpenter back yesterday.
Yes, he's been out all year.
Pitches a great game, and then they blow it in the bottom of the ninth inning.
Against the Cubs team that has nothing to play for.
Yes, so talent-wise, to me, it's still the Cardinals. But they just haven't put anything together this year. They haven't been able to do it as opposed to last year when everything was working. The Brewers are making a big run right now.
Yeah. And the Brewers are something like 20-5 in their last 25
And Braun and Weeks, and those guys are going. So
9-1 in their last 10.
9-1 in their last 10. They're a game and a half back.
Yeah.
That's not much. If you look at the Phillies, 3 games back, the Phillies end the season on the Wednesday, not next Wednesday, the Wednesday after. So they play 11 games left.
Yeah.
11 games with a 3-game gap is pretty significant.
Yeah.
So I would say it's Brewers or Cards. I say the Phillies are out, even though they have the pitching to make it really interesting.
The Brewers do have a game in hand. The Brewers have 12 games left. Everybody else there has 11 games left.
It could be a 1-game gap.
That's right.
You got me thinking about the Brewers. I kind of like the Brewers. You know, the Brewers, if
their pitching staff is scary. Well, scary good.
If the Brewers' bullpen wasn't so bad,
right.
I think they have 20-something blown saves.
Yeah.
They would be going away with this.
Yeah.
But Yovani Guerrero's pitched very well. And then Marco Estrada has come up. Sean Markham, is he back? And then the guys...
Estrada has great stuff. Not talked about much.
Estrada and Mike Fiers. Those guys...
he's been struggling a bit, though.
He's been struggling, but those guys have potential maybe to do a lot of strikeouts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very high strikeouts per nine innings and low walks. So I like them. You know, Ryan Braun, he's the
Didn't
MVP.
Didn't even mention Greinke.
Oh, yeah.
Greinke's on the Angels.
I apologize. Yeah.
Send you back to the first hour.
Yeah, sorry.
And John Axford's pitched very well after struggling, you know, a lot in their bullpen struggled. So maybe the Brewers are the Cardinals of last year where they get really hot at the end and make a run. I might go bet on them now, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, like legally.
Legally, sure, why not?
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, the NL wild card, I mean...
The Phillies, really what happened was the Phillies and the Brewers, they both got into it. The Phillies especially got into it when all the September call-ups came up.
Wow.
And they just went on a huge run. Now, the problem the Phillies are going to have, and the Phillies are going to look back, and they're going to look back probably in 2-3 weeks, or in the following Wednesday, so the beginning of October, they're going to say, if only we didn't lose 3 of 4 to the Houston Astros, because that's going to be what killed them.
Exactly right.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And jeers.
No, not good enough.
He's a bad boy.
I never seen something stinks like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Whatever sport you want, very quickly, though.
Well, I'm going to jeer, and I'm going to continue to jeer until we get a resolution. The NHL and the NHLPA, Bettman in fear for not being in a room and negotiating this week.
Yeah.
After Monday and Tuesday, or the Jewish holidays, it was Wednesday. You get into a room and you negotiate until you get a deal done. People rely on this money. And I'm not talking about the players and the owners here. I'm talking about the people who are actually employed by these companies that make modest incomes. It's enough. It's selfish. And you're getting an idea every week until this is settled.
We still wish Gary, though, a good yontif.
Gary Bettman.
But I'm gonna cheer Bobby Orr. He had a quote that I really liked. It's funny, Richie, you know, mentioned that Donald Fear and Gary Bettman should be in a room. Bobby Orr, you know, and this isn't verbatim, but Bobby Orr basically said, lock those two guys in a room, give them some bread and some water. Let them hammer out the deal and let's play hockey. So I'm going to cheer Bobby Orr for saying that because that's really what it's become at this point. We don't want to miss another year of hockey.
Quickly, I'm going to cheer baseball playoff races. You know, a lot of people may not like baseball as much as they like hockey, but without hockey, I think you should be watching baseball races.
Yep.
Every game, every pitch is very important, and this is the most exciting week of the year.
Yep, there you go. I'll wrap up cheers and jeers. I'm going to jeer really how the Derek Bougard situation has unfolded. It's just been released earlier today or late last night that Derek Bougard's family is now suing the National Hockey League's Players Association for the remaining value on his contract. They thought the NHLPA was looking after trying to get them that money. Long story short, it's going to end up in court over it, and that's obviously a tragic situation, made even more tragic by having to go to court to be resolved. That's it for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show this week. A big thank you to our guests, Randy Turner of the Winnipeg Free Press, Jonah Carey of Grantland.com, Dan Wiederer of the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and Richard Griffin of the Toronto Star. Big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, David Carr of Monopoly Realty, the Certified General Accountants Association of Manitoba, and, of course, Carbone Coal-Fired Pizza. In case you missed any of the program, it will be available for download on iTunes. Search for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, subscribe, and get it sent to your iPod each and every week. Follow us on Twitter, @IllegalCurve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And, of course, the website is www.illegalcurve.com. For Richard Pollock, for Michael Remus, for Ezra Ginsberg, and for producer Tim, I'm Drew Mandel. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
You've been listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Join us again for serious hockey talk, Saturdays from noon to 3. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, only on TSN 1290, your official home of the Winnipeg Jets.